From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we speak with a psychologist about how to best talk to your kids about the coronavirus pandemic. Then, a new report looks at the gender wage gap in Milwaukee County, which is closing, but persistent.
We compared 2010 to 2018, and we saw that the gap narrowed from women earning 81% of what men earned to 85% during that period.
Plus, how a young poet is making a statement about racial justice through her writing.
We're here because of choices, and we can choose to not be here. We can choose to turn another leaf. We can choose to go a different direction. We can choose to do better.
Plus, a poem about white privilege. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Since March, the coronavirus pandemic has changed the lives of people of all ages, but the changes have been especially challenging for parents and their children. Suddenly, kids couldn't return to school, they're stuck at home all day trying to learn virtually, and they can't visit friends or participate in many of the activities they enjoy. All kids are different, so their reactions to living under the new rules of a pandemic can vary, especially for younger children, who thrive on their daily routines. Parents are dealing with additional anxiety, tantrum behaviors, changes in eating and sleeping habits, or noticing their kids withdraw from friends and family. But there have also been positives to this experience for some children and parents who've gotten to spend more time with one another, or perhaps thrive on virtual learning. So how can we best help children adjust and understand why we have to live this way for the time being? To help answer some common questions, I'm joined by Dr. Maggie Altschaffel, a psychologist at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin Community Services. She begins by explaining some of the main concerns she's heard from parents.
You know, I think biggest concerns, right, are just dealing with that emotional reaction, how to explain what's going on, because it is so drastically different from what we've been experiencing. And then, you know, a lot of families are worried about, you know, my child's missing out maybe on 2 to 3 months of typical instruction. You know, we're doing some educational activities, but how is that going to impact their learning in the long run?
Right. And on the note of trying to explain things, so as you mentioned, different kids of different ages can handle, process things better. So is being too transparent a bad thing for children? You know, how a lot of parents are concerned of how honest are you supposed to be? Is it healthier to kind of shield them in a way, not necessarily keep them in the dark, but pick and choose how to inform the situation, especially for young kids?
I mean, I think that's a really hard thing to tackle as a parent because you want to make sure that they're staying emotionally safe, but obviously you can't shield them 100% of the time from what's going on in the world around them, especially because it's impacted their day-to-day life immediately and, you know, kind of turned things upside down. So I think the best advice that I can give to parents is that you know your child best and you've had to explain difficult things to them before. So know based on past experience sort of how much they can handle. But a good recommendation is just to sort of meet them where they are. So ask them kind of if they know kind of what's going on, answer their questions, be reassuring, use language that's developmentally appropriate. You know, so find out where they are and sort of let them take the lead. I think in terms of explaining sort of the social distancing thing for them, one of the recommendations I have is to, I guess, number one, focus on the things that we're doing as a family, as individuals, and as a community to stay safe. And I think you can use analogies like, you know, we all wash our hands, we all take showers, we cover our mouth when we cough. And so we're doing the same thing now, but just in a different and a bigger way so that we can all stay safe. You know, it's the same thing of like, you know, when you have a stomach flu, you stay home from school so we don't spread those germs to other kids. And now we all have to stay home because those germs spread so much faster that we want to just stay home so everybody doesn't get sick right now. So stay calm, be reassuring is kind of the best advice that I can give.
This pandemic obviously raises the importance of hygiene, staying clean, social distancing, because the consequences can be so dire. So how do you think it's best to talk about sickness and death with children, especially if either they see or hear of it happening on the news, or maybe even someone they know or a family member is getting severely sick or someone dies from COVID?
You know, again, every child is gonna worry about it differently. So again, meet them where they're at, and I think help them express their emotions that they're feeling inside. I think particularly with younger kids, they're gonna be having a lot of feelings, but it's gonna be really confusing for them. So different activities like drawing or playing out emotions might be helpful. And then start to have, you know, some more conversations with older children, validate their feelings, be understanding, stay calm yourselves, but they might be feeling frustrated, angry, confused. And then with older children, obviously you can give them more information as is appropriate. But I think, you know, keeping things developmentally appropriate, and again, emphasizing as much as you can that we're doing all these things to stay safe, and we'll kind of, you know, when death or, you know, if someone's going to be hospitalized in their family, you know, worry about it then, you know, because worrying about things that might happen is going to stress children out more. So kind of let's meet that challenge when it happens. And then again, going through the same process of like being reassuring, staying calm, and then asking specific questions that they have.
So children, depending on their ages, might be expressing their feelings often, as you mentioned, like through tantrums. You know, there's mood swings and anger. You know, they're sad they're missing school, their teachers, friends. There's a feeling like they're being punished for not being able to play or do their daily activities because in the past you did something wrong, so you can't do what you enjoy, right? And with tantrums taking place more frequently because they don't know how to express what they're feeling as well. You know, how do you think mood swings can best be addressed?
Right. I mean, I think the punishment thing is really a conversation to have with your child of, you know, I know it feels like you're being punished and I know it's super frustrating, but we're staying home right now and you can't play with your friends because we're all trying to be safe. So let's find some other ways that you can connect with your friends. But in terms of just sort of, as you say, like dealing with those mood swings, or there's those big tantrums or emotional outbursts, a good first step is to start to help kids practice just identifying those emotions. So when they're having a tantrum, and, you know, as long as they're, you know, when they're in that state where they're at least able to speak a little bit more, saying, you know, I see that you're having a really big feeling. Let's find a word together that shows how you feel. So some kids like to talk about it like that. So maybe make like a list. You can make an emotion vocabulary together. You can make an emotion chart. I know one of our therapists at Children's has made an emotion chart with different pictures of her dog and sort of labeled emotions. You can use emojis. You can kind of be creative and let your kid kind of explore how they want to express their emotions. You know, obviously, older children are going to be able to use words a little bit better. But, you know, some older kids and adolescents like to use art as well. And that can be a really good way to get those feelings across. Or they might want to journal about it, write a story. Maybe they want to make a TikTok, you know, about how they're feeling, right? But I think, you know, another good strategy I can offer is to model good coping yourself, you know, because as adults, we're all feeling stressed and overwhelmed and anxious. And so if you can tell them, you know, this is really hard for me, I'm feeling frustrated and anxious every day, so here's what I do to cope with those strong feelings, and this helps me feel better. Again, answer questions that they have, and reassure them that, you know, we're doing the best that we can to stay safe. And then the other thing that you can do as a parent is start teaching them some coping skills. And so there's lots of resources to help you with this. And I think a good place to start would be, you know, to reach out to your school. A lot of schools have great, well-resourced mental health professionals like school counselors, school psychologists, school social workers. So that's a good place to start for some support. But there's also, again, there's a lot of great resources both on our Children's Wisconsin website about coping skills. The Child Mind Institute has some great resources, and they do daily Facebook chats with mental health experts on their Facebook page. So that's a good place to look as well. But again, you want to look at different strategies like using art skills or doing some relaxation, doing yoga, doing breathing exercises, but doing a favorite hobby. So whatever is going to help you and your child sort of bring that emotional intensity down to a lower level, you know, whether that's doing something that's going to distract for a little bit, go outside, play a game, do an art activity, make a meal together, bake some cookies, or help doing some relaxation. Those are all some helpful strategies to use.
You brought up the counselors and resources schools provide for their kids. And, you know, that's such an important role that schools can play in a kid's life outside of their daily learning. And school just in itself, the role it can play in their mental health. So do you think that these circumstances are also making parents a little more aware of their children's mental health?
I mean, I think it's bringing more attention to mental health just sort of in general overall. But as you said, you know, I've had some parents tell me I've gotten to know my children a lot better because I'm just around them, you know, pretty much 24/7. So I definitely think that they're noticing things that upset them, maybe about specific schoolwork or transitions, especially because emotions are so heightened. So I definitely think parents are being more aware. And I think they're feeling sort of an urgency of what can I do to support them? But also maybe when is the point where I need to reach out for some additional support as well. And I think that can be a pretty scary thing because those resources look a lot differently right now because things are virtual.
Right. And is it difficult to treat children over video chat? I imagine there's screen fatigue if they're learning that way for school and entertainment and everything. And here's another thing on top of that.
No, I mean, it's been a big adjustment both for those mental health providers and for families, right? I think the good thing has been that we've learned a lot the last couple of months. You know, it depends on the family and the child, how well those virtual visits work. You know, as you said, like the fatigue for, and just that self-regulation to sit in front of a screen for a 30-minute appointment, that might not be so helpful for a six-year-old. But honestly, a lot of therapy with younger children and older children as well is appropriate, is to teach parents about behavior strategies and coping strategies that they can then use at home. And as you said, parents are the ones that, especially now, are spending more time with their children. So a lot of therapy now is helping parents both cope with the stress themselves, but then teach them some strategies to use with their children. But what's great too is that we have found, you know, with older children and adolescents that they really, really like doing virtual visits. I noticed myself that a lot of my teenager clients are more engaged over video chat than they ever were when I see them face to face, just because it seems to be a lot more natural connection for them. And I think particularly some of our more anxious adolescents, and especially now when emotions are heightened, that if they're able to sit in their own room, you know, snuggled up with their dogs, they're a lot more willing to talk about things that are going on because they feel safer in that space. So for some kids, it's been a good change. And, you know, we've made a lot of progress because, you know, they're able to connect in a different way.
When it comes to, I'm especially thinking of younger children, when you're first going to school, those initial few years, you know, the social and emotional needs of children involves interacting with other children. And each child has a different home situation. Maybe they have siblings around the same age. Maybe they don't. If they're an only child, you know, no matter how many virtual play dates, there's no equivalent of physically playing and learning with your peers in that way. So what does not being around other kids right now do for their development and functioning?
I mean, it's good to keep practicing, you know, those basic social skills that we can do with adults as well. It would take a lot of like an extremely long time, like several years of not interacting with other kids for you to really lose those basic skills. There's definitely going to be a transition period when hopefully we're able to go back into physical school buildings, however that's going to look, where we're going to have to, you know, have a lot of reteaching of some skills about how we interact with other kids at school and how we follow behavior expectations so that everybody stays safe and is able to learn. But I think the good thing to think about, and, you know, something to help ease parents' anxiety about this, is that schools are already thinking about that of, my goodness, our children are going to be, have, you know, out of school for several months when we're able to come back. And so schools are already preparing for what that's going to look like. And so they're definitely going to be more focused on how can we support children both emotionally and socially when they come back to school, because they're going to have been through so much. And as you said, they're going to be out of practice with those, you know, how to interact with kids safely on the playground. Like, how do I sit still for 10 minutes to do a spelling lesson? And you know, how do I express empathy skills with other kids? Because maybe I haven't been around them in so long. So as adults, we're all concerned about that. But the best thing you can do is just, you know, make your child feel safe right now. And I wouldn't worry too much, because it's, you know, they've had a lot of practice so far. So kids are very resilient. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, so that they'll bounce back. Yeah.
So while parents are top of mind thinking of how are we going to cope through this time, a lot of people are concerned that kids are losing out on lessons, on learning time for these months of school. How would you address those concerns?
Sure. So I think number one, realize that teachers are all in this experience as well. And so they're going to be aware that students might have missed out on some of those last couple of months of curriculum items. So they know they might have to backtrack a little bit to pick up on those missing skills or missing topics in science or social studies. But in terms of sort of recommendations of what we can do, you know, now and over the summer, is if you're concerned about sort of those basic skills and learning in general, it's just to keep practicing those, like reading with your kids, or for younger kids, like working on letter identification, working with number sense, math fluency facts, and then continue to build those like problem solving skills and critical thinking skills with like science and experiments and projects. And I think what can be really helpful with kids, if you let them, you know, pick the topic that they want to do, whether if they're interested in like baseball or learning about specific people, like dinosaurs, or you can like pick a local spot to do a history report on, like maybe like the history of the Milwaukee County Park System, or like make it really interesting to them, just so they keep kind of like practicing those skills, and that'll help them transition back when they have to go back to school.
One concern that I heard is, do you think there will be any kind of waves of separation anxiety from parents once whatever school turns out to be, and especially depending on if kids need to wear masks, if there will be barriers, it might be a very different atmosphere than what they left. Or is it even too soon to think about that? Is that something we should worry about when time comes for kids to go back to school, to worry about that transition back?
So I definitely think it's something to be aware of, but I don't think at this point you need to worry about it. You know, I think the fact that it's on our minds is good, because we can do things now to make sure that our kids are more prepared, you know, when that transition is going to come. So that's things like working on identifying emotions, teaching them coping skills. But I think another important thing is just building your relationship with your child, so that when we are transitioning back to school and that's going to be so difficult, they have that sort of like base attachment relationship where they're feeling safe. So they will be able to, you know, go back, re-enter the world. And then when they're having difficulties, come back to you as a safe place to share their concerns and to work through things.
So of course, screen time has been a big issue before the pandemic. And of course, it's being used as an educational tool. If kids are younger, it's a means to keep them occupied while parents try to work. So is the impact of such increased and potentially excessive screen time as parents struggle to work from home, do you see like long-term repercussions of this? Or is this another matter of, this is what we're doing to make it through the time right now?
I guess, I mean, my initial response is you got to do what you got to do to get through the day, right? But I would also, but like sort of in terms of like tips of screen time, you want to make sure it's more about like what they're doing on the screen more than, you know, just screen time itself. And so there are a lot of great educational activities to do. It's also the main way that we're connecting with others, right? So we're going to be using screens to do that. So there are activities that are going to be good, right? Like playing video games is a way to like interact with their friends if they're doing that online. They're problem solving, they're using fine motor skills to operate that control as well. So screen time isn't bad in and of itself. Again, set expectations about what are my expectations for what you're going to be doing on the screen time. Monitor that. Make sure that they're taking breaks, you know, because eye strain can be a concern. And again, as we kind of said before, with being apart from their peers and not interacting with others, it takes a lot of screen time in order to have impact on cognitive development. And we've also know that it's really for a small percentage of kids where it's really going to have a big impact on any cognitive development at all. So I wouldn't panic about it, and realize that this is not something that we usually do, that you get to be on the screen all day. But, you know, have breaks, make sure they're doing other activities so they're getting in that exercise as well. But unfortunately, just sometimes that's the strategy that we have to go to.
In the meantime, a lot of parents, of course, struggling to work full-time from home while their kids are there. And if they have older children, perhaps it's easier to understand boundaries and you do your schoolwork, I need to do my work. But if you have young kids who associate you being home with it's the evening or it's the weekend and this is our time together, and there's, of course, feelings of parental guilt, not being able to give your focus to all of the things, work and your kids, and maybe your kids feel like they're being ignored or not giving the attention they need. How can this be addressed in a helpful way to help kids understand the new reality they're facing for a little while?
Sure. I think number one is to give yourself some grace, have some self-compassion, and realize that, you know, we have really good intentions. And so not every day is going to go as planned. And you're doing the best that you can to sort of fulfill those multiple roles in your life. You know, whether it's being a good parent or, you know, working from home or spending time with other family and friends as you can. So that's a really difficult thing to do. So give yourself some grace, have some self-compassion. But I think a good way to go about this, I get this question a lot, is to set those expectations, you know, every day about, you know, from 8 to 10 is going to be some school time. And this is what that means. So I need you to work a little bit and we'll check in every 30 minutes. But this is a time when I have to get some work done myself. So setting some expectations and then give them a lot of verbal reinforcement or other reinforcement, whether that's a special treat or if you play a game, like if you guys work for 2 hours, we'll play Monopoly together. So again, I think setting some expectations so that they know what to expect, reinforcing them so they're learning how to behave appropriately when you need them to do so. But I think allowing yourself to set those expectations is good. And as you said, like we need to set some boundaries so that you're able to fulfill some other obligations.
Do you have any suggestions of how parents can help balance this if they have kids that are too young to even have a school routine?
So I think for younger kids, you know, unfortunately, it really depends on how well your child has developed some self-regulation skills, and that varies child by child for a lot of different reasons. So I think, you know, expect small bursts of being able to sort of occupy themselves, work when you're able to. And I know that's frustrating in and of itself, right? To not be able to, you know, sit down and work for a couple hours like you maybe need to. But also I think if you sort of reframe the situation yourself of, instead of, man, this is so frustrating, I can't get any work done, I don't know how I'm going to be able to do this. But sometimes being able to think, what a great opportunity that I'm able to spend some more time at home and build a relationship with my kids and get to know them better. But realize too that you don't have to have that attitude every day. Like some days are just going to be frustrating, and try as we might to have some good coping thoughts, it's extremely difficult to do that. So again, having self-compassion, being kind to ourselves, and realizing that not every day is going to go well, but as much as you can, take that time to set some boundaries, as much as you can set some activities up for those younger kiddos.
So overall, learn coping skills, learn how to identify emotions with your kids, and have compassion for everybody. Is that your main tips and takeaways?
Yeah, that is a good summary. And that's, you know, skills we can work on as adults as well.
Dr. Maggie Alt-Schaefel is a psychologist at the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin Community Services. She joined us to talk about how to talk to your kids about the coronavirus pandemic and all the changes we're experiencing. You can find links to some of the resources Dr. Alt-Schaefel mentioned at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we take a look at the Wisconsin Policy Forum's latest report on the gender wage gap. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Over the last couple of decades, the gender pay gap has been narrowing nationwide, but it still remains a very real problem. A new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum has found that here in Milwaukee County, women make around 85 cents for every dollar that a man makes. In Waukesha County, it's just 76 cents to every dollar made by a man. This disparity has a lot of consequences, and it often stems from a lot of different factors based on our cultural perceptions of gender roles. Betsy Miller and Joe Pietrangelo are the authors of the report titled Milwaukee's Gender Pay Gap Narrows But Persists, and they join Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about it.
When we look at the hard numbers in this report, obviously they have to be contextualized, but overall, without going into different factors outside of gender, what does the disparity look like here in Milwaukee County?
Overall, when we look at the median annual earnings of women compared to men, the median among women is about 85% the median among men. That's when we look at all workers who work full-time. It's different depending on what occupation you're looking at, but that's sort of the big picture view of it. So 85% in Milwaukee County, that's compared to 76% in Waukesha County and 79% nationally. So the gap is actually a little bit smaller in Milwaukee County than it is nationally, and we can get into understanding that a little bit better.
Yeah, let's dig into some of the different factors. What does the disparity look like when we account for race? That seems to have a big impact.
The data we had wasn't able to get at the level of race and gender by occupation, for example, so we couldn't get to that level. But when we look at national data, we see that Black, Hispanic, and American Indian women earn the lowest median incomes overall. So it's particularly a challenge. The gap is then bigger between women in some of those groups or all of those groups than they are among men overall. So the gap is just that much more difficult to close.
Yeah, unfortunately, that data wasn't available at the local level. It would have been really great to see that. But when you break down all of these categories, the number of people is just so small that sometimes it's not available. So,
well, I think that gets to a bigger question about these kinds of reports. I think invariably, there's a group of people who wants to cast doubt on any study that points to gender or racial inequities. How are these kinds of reports compiled? What is the kind of data that you used to create this research?
So the data that we used in this report is from the census. The American Community Survey is the yearly sort of larger survey that goes with the census. So Census Bureau data, which is available on a variety of levels. Here we've got Milwaukee County, which is the smallest one we were looking at in terms of, you know, national, state, county. And then we sort of tried to bring in a little bit of research as well to complement that to show what some of the other factors are that go into the pay gap.
And what are some of those factors?
So we looked at some academic studies. So of course, with something as complex as the pay gap, there are people who spend, you know, their entire academic careers studying this and trying to break down what that is. And we wanted to just provide sort of a high level overview of what some of those factors that go into the pay gap might be. And so that's sort of what we tried to bring into the piece as well as the census data.
So just to take a step back, the purpose of doing this study was to go beyond just looking at that high level number of what is the, you know, income of women compared to men overall. That was sort of the starting place, but our purpose was to understand that better, to get into the details of what drives it, partly by looking at differences in occupations and how women are more concentrated in certain occupations that pay lower wages, or that women are less represented in some of the highest positions within many occupations, the ones that pay the highest within a given occupation. So we wanted to understand some of those factors, and then also some of the other factors that, you know, go beyond just what occupations women are in, and get into things like caregiving. We looked at the fact that women are more likely than men to take time for raising kids or taking care of other family members, and how that plays into it, and gender discrimination, which you mentioned. We wanted to kind of give a big picture look at many of the factors, because it's a very complicated picture.
It is a complicated picture. And I think when you read the report, it shows just how complicated that looks. And one of the things that you do is you created a number of charts that looks at different professions and how job choice, the kinds of professions that women tend to go into, how that can account for some of this disparity. What does that look like? How does that play out?
There are differences in where women are more and less represented, like I mentioned, in different occupational groups. So, for example, we found that women are very underrepresented in architecture and engineering and computer and mathematical occupations. Those are a couple examples of occupations that pay pretty high salaries and that women are still really underrepresented. It's only 20-21% of people in those occupations from Milwaukee County are women. And you have some occupations like healthcare support and office and administrative support that employ large numbers of women, and women are dominate in those fields, but they pay low wages, relatively low wages. Those are some of the examples. And then within certain occupations, like, for example, when we looked at the legal occupation, the biggest gap in Milwaukee County in terms of what women make versus men is in legal occupations. So that is driven by the fact that women are very underrepresented as judges and lawyers. And most of the people who work in legal support occupations, so some of the lower wage occupations within the legal field, are women. So that kind of division leads to this pay gap within that occupation. So that's just an example of the way this plays out throughout the economy.
Yeah, you mapped out what those disparities looked like inside of different occupational groups. You mentioned legal, which was pretty shocking to look at. So the reason it seems that there are these big disparities inside of each of these groups is because of the kinds of positions people tend to hold inside of, you know, the legal profession or healthcare or, you know, education.
That's definitely one factor, you know, in many fields is like I said, that in some cases, women are underrepresented in some of the highest paying positions within them. Another example was management occupation. So women in general are pretty equally represented as managers of all kinds. But when you look at top executives, only 37% of top executives are women. So that when you look at the overall pay gap, women are only making about 80% of what men are overall among people in management. So that's an example. But then those other factors that we discussed help to drive that. Things like women taking more time out of their careers are more likely to take time out for caregiving, and also, you know, gender discrimination and other factors.
Well, and that gets to another thing the report looks at, of course, is the social expectations that are placed on women. Caregiving being just one of them, but something that can have a pretty disproportionate impact on their income. What are some of these social forces that account for the disparities we see play out?
We tried to include just sort of an overview of what these are, and of course, it's hard to say exactly how much each contributes to the wage gap. So we talked about caregiving, which includes sort of women might be more likely to choose to work part-time than men, which our data looked at full-time workers, but if you include part-time workers, that would be a whole other universe of workers. Just to allow for, you know, more greater flexibility within their schedules and to balance their work and their home responsibilities.
We also talk about how there's been an evolution over time in terms of what occupations women are represented in or where they're evenly represented in. And there are still some gaps, like I mentioned, things like architecture and engineering. So there are differences in what men and women have perceived to be good career choices or appropriate career choices for them. And that's been changing over time, but it hasn't completely changed throughout all jobs where women are equally represented with men in every field.
You know, there are a lot of analyses on the amount of emotional labor, but also just physical labor in the form of housework and child rearing after work and the variety of things that come with taking care of a home, that will show women are spending a very disproportionate amount of their free time, quote unquote free time, I suppose, working versus men. But it feels like such an intangible kind of thing and a really difficult thing to kind of grasp how it impacts our work. How do you incorporate that into a report?
Mm-hmm. And there are studies that try to quantify, you know, what percent of the gap is due to which factors, and reasonable people disagree on what those numbers are. But I think what generally is agreed on in the academic research is that it's a very complex issue and there's a lot of factors that go into it. And so in creating a solution, you have to find solutions that are equally complex to address the issue.
And somehow intersectional?
Yes.
So the gap is narrowing a bit here, but at what pace?
So in Milwaukee County, we compared 2010 to 2018, and we saw that the gap narrowed from women earning 81% of what men earned to 85% during that period. So there was some closing of the gap. We also saw that it had closed in Waukesha County. It had closed from 70 to 76%, and then nationally from 77 to 79%. So there is a slow closing of the gap, and that's only looking over an 8-year period. But there's also evidence that it's slowing somewhat. At least a lot of national research says that the closing of the gap is starting to slow down. And so there's no guarantee that it'll continue to close at the same pace. Initial data is showing that women are more likely than men to have lost their job due to the pandemic. And so there's a chance that that could make the pay gap actually worse over time. So that's concerning. But then on the other hand, we don't know exactly how this is going to play out. And a possible silver lining of all of this is that in a lot of different occupations, new work structures and schedules have come about, more people working from home, more flexible schedules. And a lot of the research shows that those are the things that often drive women to choose certain fields or not choose certain fields, is the lack of flexibility in their schedules. And so that is something that if that continues, at least in those fields that have started to have more flexibility, it might actually help to narrow the gap in the long term.
Betsy Miller is a researcher and Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Their recent report titled Milwaukee's Gender Pay Gap Narrows But Persists can be found at wispolicyforum.org. After the break, we hear from a young Milwaukee poet who is writing about racial justice. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Before the nation learned the names of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, there was Ahmaud Arbery. A video of his killing surfaced months after it happened. It showed two white men chasing him down as he went for a jog in Brunswick, Georgia. Arbery was shot and killed, and both men were later charged after anger erupted over the video. After the video went public, NPR put out a call for people to write a poem about Arbery. NPR then pulled lines and portions of poems that were submitted to create one poem in his memory. One of the lines in the poem was taken from 18-year-old Milwaukee native Amira Pearsall's poem. She spoke with WUWM's Latoya Dennis about the larger fight for racial justice. She starts by explaining why she chose to write her poem.
It wasn't so much a decision as it just felt like something I had to do. I was lying on the couch at my grandfather's house and it was like 11 o'clock at night. I was supposed to be sleeping like ages ago, but I just felt like I couldn't go to sleep until I got the words out. And I just remember feeling just so choked up and angry and helpless and so sad. And I just felt like I didn't know what to do with all that grief. And I just felt like I just really couldn't go to sleep until I wrote it. So I wrote it. And then I went to sleep. And then I woke up the next day and I read it. And I worked on it some more. And then it felt like I had this weight lifting off of my chest. I am sorry that your life has become a metaphor. I am sorry the only song they know to sing for you is tragedy. Sorry they have made you more than what you were, more than what you were ever meant to be. Sorry I cannot ask what you would have wanted. Sorry, my fingers are stained with ink while a sidewalk exists that is stained with your blood. I am sorry that we all know your name now, that we will forget it far too soon. I am sorry that your story was written for you, that we have made you the hero of a battle you never got to choose. I am sorry they still insist justice is blind when we know she just does not exist for us. I am sorry that we cannot do more. That all I can do is write this poem. That I do not know enough to do more. I am sorry that it does not matter that I am sorry. I am sorry that I have made this about me. I am sorry that this is not enough. Will never be enough. I am sorry. I am sorry. I am sorry. It wasn't about me. But it felt like, it definitely felt cathartic. And it definitely felt like the embodiment of just, like, all of this hopelessness and all of this emotion that I just hadn't been able to express. And I just really felt like I wanted to do something because I saw everyone doing things in solidarity, saying, I run with Maude. And then it just felt like, at the same time, it just, all of it felt so superficial, like, this man, countless men and countless women have lost their lives in this way. And it's just like, all we can do is make a hashtag.
Now, we're talking right now about the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. But after his death, both Breonna Taylor and George Floyd were killed by police officers in Louisville, Kentucky and Minneapolis, Minnesota. And since then, we've seen protests across the country, most of them in response to police brutality against Black people. You've both organized a protest and you've been a participant in others. Why?
I think it's important for our voices to be heard, and it's important to show solidarity and to just do that as a part of a community and stand united in, like, shared beliefs and fighting for what we believe in and working towards a better future.
If there were a soundtrack to what you're feeling right now, what would a couple of the songs on that soundtrack be?
I have a lot of songs that I'm feeling. It depends on the exact hour of the day, but right now, This Is America by Childish Gambino. The revolution will not be televised.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. Revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought
it's
to you.
Like, I was on this pilgrimage with my school, and like one of the biggest messages they had was praying with your feet. And while I'm personally not incredibly religious, the idea of like work and putting in effort and actually like manifesting what you want to see, like that really stuck with me.
You know, you've grown up in Milwaukee, a city often cited as one of the most segregated in the U.S. What's been your experience?
Segregation is just like a part of living in Milwaukee. And I think that's just noticeable. Like, when you're just driving around, you'll see heavily desegregated communities. You know, this is where the Black people live, this is where the white people live. And then I've lived in predominantly Black neighborhoods, I've lived in predominantly white neighborhoods, and it's just always just knowing that, like, you're not somewhere you belong and feeling like an outsider. Like, when I've lived in, like, mostly white neighborhoods, it's just been, like, it hasn't felt safe, just because I've known that I am not welcome, or that I have to prove myself, or that, like, just constantly feeling like you have to be on your best behavior. And then also, like, but that's just everyday stuff. There's also, like, blatant racism that goes on too. There's microaggressions. It's just racism, experiencing racism, I feel like, is just, like, an intrinsic part of being Black in America. Like, I don't even know if I have one large traumatic experience. Honestly, I probably do, but like, in this moment, it's just like, yeah, I've experienced racism, and yeah, it's hurt me, and yeah, I've seen it hurt the people I care about. And it's just an awareness all the time of just, like, the color of my skin and how I carry myself and how other people may perceive me because of that. And just an awareness of things I can and can't do.
How has it shaped you?
Just, like, living with, like, this pervasive, like, almost fear, just awareness. I've become aware of a lot of things that my white friends don't have to be aware of. Just the language I use, the way I talk in certain situations, where I go, how I dress, what I say, how I say it. And also just, it's exhausting too, to just live with that fear and to just carry that. And then being expected to turn the other cheek as well. It's always interesting to me how marginalized and oppressed groups are exploited, are killed, are treated horribly, and then they're expected to educate the oppressor, or turn the other cheek, or take the high road, or they'll be labeled as just another stereotype, or they'll just be, like, reinforcing all of the negative things that people say about that group, and they'll be used as an example to just prove the point. And it's weird feeling constantly like a representative of an entire race, because, like, I am proud of being Black, and that's, like, an intrinsic part of my identity. Like, I'm Black, and that's not something that can be separated from who I am. But at the same time, it's like, yes, I'm Black, and yes, I have a voice that matters, and yes, I have a lot to say. And I'm not, like, a representative of the Black race. Like, everything I do shouldn't be used to prove or disprove whether Black people deserve rights.
So, at this moment in time, where we are as a society and where you are in your life, your young life, because, again, you're only 18 years old, what do you want people to know?
I just want people to know that, like, where we're at, we're here because of choices that people made. And we're here because, like, the system requires, like, to function, it needs people to be at the bottom, it needs people to be at the top. And we're here because of choices, mostly just choices. Like, people in power made choices, and then people supported those people in power. We're here because of choices, and we can choose to not be here. We can choose to turn another leaf. We can choose to go a different direction. We can choose to do better. And, like, of course, I mean we as, like, a society, and not as, like, Black people need to work harder to prove that they deserve rights. But, like, we as a society, as a community, as, like, a global family, we can do better.
Amira Pearsall is a Milwaukee native who wrote a poem about Ahmaud Arbery for NPR. She spoke with WUWM's Latoya Dennis. Coming up next, contributor Sean Ramft shares his poem about his privilege as a white man in America. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Along with the discussions and marches for Black Lives Matter, another phrase people are learning more about is white privilege. It's a term that refers to the inherent advantages that come from being white, in a culture with pervasive and enduring racial inequity. As a white man, our poetry contributor Sean Ramft has been reflecting on the recent protests, and he asks other white people to do the same in his poem, Privilege.
Privileges, being able to say all lives matter while living out your day, while being without fear, while breathing without care as another struggles for air. They deflect from injustice. They remove from confrontation. Those three words, just a vicious reaction to those who simply want to be treated as human. Privileges, being able to wake up without constant dread in the back of your head. Privileges, being able to write this without ever knowing how dangerous it is just to breathe, just to be. Passive discomfort isn't an excuse for silence. Potential confrontation isn't an excuse for injustice. Privilege is being able to choose to do nothing. But yet, you tell yourself those three words, all lives matter. Because you don't have to care. Because you don't have to fear. They serve as a blanket, shielding you from the grim reality that dares to alter your ideals. Disingenuous at best. Irreparably harmful at worst. That's privilege. We see the faces. We hear the voices. But we choose silence because it soothes. And it's long past time to convert comfort into confrontation. Privilege is being able to decide that you don't have to decide. And that's power you can't buy.
Sean Ramft is a poetry contributor for Lake Effect, and you can find more of his work at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.